New research shows babies born in segregated neighborhoods in the U.S. are more likely to have poor birth outcomes. But researchers say it doesn't have to be this way, and we can look to Canada for ideas.
Toronto shows us a very different outcome, where they've effectively broken the link between racial ethnic composition of a community and low birth weight. And in Chicago, we suffer from very severe and avoidable health inequities that could be avoided, that could be different.
Plus, Governor Rauner last week signed into law several measures related to mental health and substance abuse.
We didn't let partisanship get in the middle of it. We said we've got to deliver high-quality mental health services. Mental health drives all health. We need outstanding mental health services in the state of Illinois.
We'll learn how these new laws are expected to increase access to help for people who need it. And Google Chicago is looking to give out $1 million to Illinois nonprofits. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone had a good weekend. Coming up later this hour, Chicago and Toronto are both diverse cities that are about the same size. But when it comes to the health of our babies, our neighbors to the north are doing a much better job. We're going to find out what lessons we can learn. Also, Google Chicago is looking to give out $1 million to nonprofits throughout Illinois. We'll tell you how to apply. But first, state lawmakers may be out of session. There's still a lot up in the air as far as which bills will turn into laws. That's because Governor Rauner has been pretty busy the past week and a half, signing and vetoing so many bills, whether we're talking about teacher salaries, immigration, or health care. Some of his actions have been making mental health advocates cheer, while others are upsetting teachers and immigrant rights advocates. Of course, all of this is the governor continues a tough reelection campaign against Democratic nominee J.B. Pritzker. We're going to break all of this down with public radio reporters Dave McKinney, who's on the line from WBEZ Chicago. In studio with me here in Urbana is WILL's Christine Herman. Hey, guys. Good morning. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla.
Hey, Nyla.
Dave, let's start with there's so many bills that were signed or vetoed last week. We're going to be able to talk about some, not all of them. But I want to start with a bill that we saw a lot of news about over the weekend. It would have raised the minimum salary requirement for Illinois public school teachers by 2022. Governor Rauner vetoed this, Dave?
Yeah, he vetoed it. This bill would have established a $40,000 pay threshold for teachers by 2022. And, you know, right now there are, I think, 17 states across the country that have some sort of, you know, minimum pay standard, Illinois being one of them. And the current law that Illinois has hasn't been updated for decades, and it has a $10,000 minimum threshold. Rauner vetoed it, and I don't think that it's terribly surprising. I mean, he and the teachers' unions, as well as all of the public sector unions, he's been at war with them. So I don't think anyone was holding out great hope that this was going to be something the governor would suddenly, you know, have an epiphany on and sign. But, we've seen in other states where teachers have become increasingly politically active. Pay has been kind of the focal point, you know, in states like West Virginia and others where it's just, you know, a lot of teachers are arguing that they're not being paid enough. The unions have said this is a tool to get teachers to come into you know, more rural, poorer school districts if you can establish a minimum pay threshold.
Mm-hmm. Right. We've seen reaction, of course, as you said, Dave, from the Illinois Federation of Teachers, from J.B. Pritzker, saying he will sign this if he becomes governor. So I think a lot of these, as we're talking about, these bills are also in the context of this political campaign, which I want to get back to with you, Dave, in a minute. But Christine, I wanted to ask you about, on the other hand, Governor Rauner has signed a series of bills about mental health and substance abuse that advocates have long been waiting and hoping for. Let's start first. He signed a bill on telemedicine. What's that about?
So let's start with what telemedicine is. So if you can imagine, it's sort of like FaceTiming with your doctor. So instead of having to drive to the hospital or to the clinic setting, you can be on your computer on a computer screen, and basically the doctor can do an assessment, the doctor or whoever the provider is. So currently, there are private insurance companies that will cover these types of telemedicine services. But right now, Medicaid, which is regulated by the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services, they limit telehealth services to only medical doctors being able to provide services to patients who are in a hospital or clinic setting, you know, in a remote area. So what this bill does, what this new law does, is it expands it to different providers, which could include clinical psychologists, social workers, and behavioral health providers. And then it also allows patients to be seen not just in a hospital or clinic setting, but it could even increase access to, for example, in a school district. So you can imagine, like, if there's a school district that isn't able to pay for a provider, like a mental health counselor, psychologist, to come, they could, this opens up to for schools to be able to create programs where they wouldn't have to pay the, if the patient is covered by Medicaid, they can get those services to that child in a school setting, for example, and then that provider would be able to bill for those services through the Medicaid program.
Right. And so telemedicine, of course, it sounds like a big help, particularly for people outside of our largest cities where there right. are big hospitals. And Christine, also to this point of mental health, a few weeks ago on the program, we were talking about your story you've been reporting. It's a really tragic story of a mom who had to give up custody of her child because she couldn't afford the mental health care that he needed and her insurance wouldn't cover it. Governor Rauner also signed some bills that would help people in this situation.
Right. So there are two of them. One of them would basically strengthen enforcement of existing mental health parity laws in the state. So mental health parity basically means that an insurance company cannot treat, offer coverage that's different for mental health or substance use, substance abuse treatment than they would for any other physical medical condition. So the example of the family, they couldn't get their insurance company, neither Medicaid or their private insurance company, to cover this treatment for their child. And so this would hopefully, this allows the Illinois Department of Insurance to do more, have more oversight of companies and ensures that insurance companies are being more transparent about how they're offering mental health and substance use treatment. So hopefully that would help parents of children who are in this situation not have to do this unthinkable workaround of giving up custody of their child to get them treatment.
And that's a very extreme situation, but it also just sounds like this parity, the whole idea that mental health services are on par with medical, physical help. Is that an unusual position for a state to take?
Well, so the mental health advocates in Illinois say that our laws, our mental health parity laws, are some of the strictest in the country. There are federal laws that have been on the books for a decade now, but this supposedly our state now is going to have some of the strictest trying to enforce and make sure that insurance companies are doing what they're supposed to be doing.
So really setting a new standard, mm-hmm. hopefully, for behavioral health across the country.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other bill, it really gets at helping people get early intervention. So after the first incident of first episode of psychosis, they would, if the child or the patient is covered by Medicaid, this law would create a Medicaid pilot program that would have programs that are tailored specifically to children in those situations. So when we spoke a couple weeks ago, it was with Heather O'Donnell. She's a senior vice president of advocacy and public policy at Thresholds, which is a behavioral health provider in Chicago. Here's what she said at the signing of this bill last week.
You would think that early treatment is what we would expect for mental health and addictions, but oftentimes people wait years, sometimes decades, before they are able to get treatment. And they suffer significant debilitating conditions in the lag time that they're able to get treatment.
That's Heather O'Donnell, who's a senior vice president of advocacy and public policy for Thresholds. They're a behavioral health provider in Chicago. Christine Herman, so it sounds like this bill would help at least lay the groundwork for something like this to happen.
Yeah, it still needs federal approval to get funding to pay for the Medicaid portion. But once that's approved, that there should be early intervention, and there should also be not just for mental health, but also for substance use, for in-home and community treatment for clinical substance use treatment. And, you know, Heather O'Donnell at that signing, she said Illinois is going to be the first state in the country to have this treatment approach through Medicaid.
Right. So, of course, you said not just behavioral health, but substance abuse.
Yes.
So this could be a key tactic in fighting against people who have opioid addictions,
yes.
it sounds
mm-hmm.
like. Dave McKinney, can I switch tacks and ask you about another bill? We've been talking about bills the governor has passed. I want to ask you about another bill the governor vetoed. This is related to the outbreaks of Legionnaires' disease at a veterans home in Quincy. You and Tony Arnold have been reporting extensively on this. And just as a reminder to our listener, there's been 14 deaths at the veterans home since 2015 because of the Legionella bacteria. Dave, late last week, Governor Rauner issued an amendatory veto of a bill related to families getting compensation. What did he say?
Well, I mean, the crux of what the legislature did following our stories was that they addressed this threshold that exists, and it's been around since the early 1970s. In cases where somebody sues the state, you know, imagine you're walking on a sidewalk at a university, you trip and fall and hit your head. You know, you have to go into a very obscure legal venue called the Court of Claims to sue the state. And so there are lots of cases that wind up there, and the most that anybody can recover in suing the state typically is $100,000. I mean, there's a carve out for car crashes, but this is largely what the cap has been. And after these veterans and residents of the Illinois Veterans Home in Quincy died, there was a push in the legislature to increase that $100,000 threshold up to $2 million. Because in cases, I mean, you can look all over the country really, and in these Legionnaires cases, you know, largely preventable if the water systems and buildings and hotels and nursing homes are clean. But in the cases where people have gotten this and gotten sick or died and sued, there has been, you know, typical payouts of, you know, $1 million, $2 million, because, you know, again, this is a largely preventable thing. And so the legislation that passed would have raised the cap from $100,000 to $2 million for these families. Rauner didn't like the increase. He thought that it would expose the state to all sorts of frivolous lawsuits and further drain a cash-depleted state treasury even farther. And so he rewrote that bill and suggested a $300,000 cap, so it would increase it to $300,000 from $100,000. J.B. Pritzker this morning has been on the attack, as have other legislators over the weekend. And it looks like there's going to be a good override battle brewing in November over this bill that, passed with veto-proof majorities back in the spring.
That's what I was just going to ask you. I know Tony Arnold over the weekend spoke to at least one lawmaker who said they wanted to try to override this veto. So the numbers, at least when it passed, were there are numbers to override this amendatory veto if lawmakers choose to do so.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, based on those earlier roll calls, if the majorities hold together, and it's sort of hard to envision why they wouldn't, because, you know, the way this bill has been spun, you know, these families were, not most of the ones we talked to, in fact, all of them, said that they were not in this for the money. They just simply want an acknowledgement from the state that things were not handled properly in 2015 and 2016 and 2017. And again, this year, when people kept getting sick and in many cases dying from contaminated water at the veterans home.
And Dave, I wanted to ask you said something about Governor Rauner talking about preventing the state from frivolous lawsuits. These are lawsuits filed on behalf of people whose family members have died, correct?
Well, yeah, these particular ones certainly are. There are, as you mentioned, a dozen of them. And again, if we go back and review what their basic stories are, I mean, these folks were people who, for the most part, I mean, they were elderly residents, but at the same time, most of them had their health still. And, you know, the way Legionnaires works, you know, if you've got it in your piping system, if you breathe in the vapor from like a shower, for example, or, you know, they have whirlpool tubs that, the elderly people there were using to help with joint pain and whatever, you know, if you're breathing in contaminated vapor, it gets in your lungs, and then it can turn into a form of pneumonia that is really hard to overcome if it's not treated properly. But, you know, if you give somebody antibiotics, typically they respond to it. And in this case, they didn't have much recognition of what was going on there, that there was a long lag in testing for these folks. Some people were just treated simply with Tylenol. And as they got sicker and sicker, nobody seemed to know why in the early stages. And you had people, 1 weekend seeming fine, and then later that week, all of a sudden they were dead. And so there's a push for justice for these people, and it would seem that again, based on the way those roll calls looked back in the spring, that the majorities favor a bill like this, and Rauner, unless he works some magic, is probably going to face a loss on this.
Mm. I wanted to ask you, just end by Dave McKinney asking you about a package of five bills that were sent to Governor Rauner's desk for potential immigration laws. He vetoed three of them. He signed two of them. I wanted to focus on one of the bills he vetoed called the Voices Act, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to tell you, I haven't done a ton of homework on this bill, but I know that there was a, these immigration bills really have put Rauner on the spot. They were passed out of the Democratic-led legislature here, I think, in response to what Trump is doing on the national level.
Right, and I wanted to ask you about that, Dave. The Voices Act, this would have required Illinois law enforcement to sign off on immigration paperwork within 90 days for immigrant victims who help police and prosecutors bring criminal to justice. That's what was vetoed. We're going to get into that in a few minutes after the break. But Dave, just before we break here, I wanted to just ask, former Republican Governor Jim Edgar actually wrote an op-ed in the Sun-Times urging Governor Rauner to sign all five of these bills, saying this was humane and it was the right thing to do. But to your point, the other wing of the party, Trump supporters, who were very upset at Governor Rauner for signing another immigration bill, the Trust Act, I wonder if these vetoes signal a move more to the Trump side of the GOP.
Well, I mean, it's kind of an unusual thing because you think, I mean, typically what we see in Illinois politics and when you get into a general election with these statewide office holders, they tend to move more toward the middle. But I think, you know, with Rauner, he still is having difficulty in shoring up his Republican base. I mean, there's a conservative wing that, you know, has upset at him, as you mentioned, on immigration, upset that he signed legislation to expand public support for abortions. And so he's going into this general election against J.B. Pritzker, you know, kind of with one arm tied behind his back because the conservatives are not fully behind him. And so I think this is a token to them to try to get them on board with him.
We are going to, after the break, follow up on this conversation with Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. Andy Kang's going to be joining us. I want to thank Dave McKinney from WBEZ, WILL's Christine Herman for being with us as well. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks, Nyla.
WILL programming is made possible in part by Krannert Arch Museum at the University of Illinois, opening its fall season with the CAMFest opening night celebration, Thursday, August 30th at 7 p.m. More information is available online at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just tuning in this Monday, we're catching up on the many bills that Governor Rauner has been busy signing and vetoing. A lot of those have to do with immigration. And one of those bills that he vetoed is called the Voices Act. Its supporters say it will help protect unauthorized immigrants who are victims of domestic violence or sexual abuse. But Governor Rauner vetoed this late last week. Everyone from his opponent in the governor's race, J.B. Pritzker, to immigrant rights activists are decrying these vetoes. On the line with us now is one of those activists. Andy Kang is executive director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Andy, so the governor signed two of these, of this package of five bills, the governor signed two and vetoed three. Were you surprised by the three bills that the governor vetoed?
Yes, I was. In particular, the Voices Act. I mean, as you mentioned, this is something that ensures survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and I should add human trafficking, making sure that they get the help they deserve from local law enforcement. And, happy to talk more about that, but this was something that we passed in a bipartisan fashion this spring with the Illinois General Assembly. It was something that House Republican leader Jim Durkin voted for. That was one of the chief co-sponsors was a Republican legislator. And then more recently, former Republican Governor Jim Edgar wrote a Sun-Times piece in support of the bill. So we were surprised in particular that the Voices Act was one of the bills that he chose to veto.
So I do want to get into the Voices Act in a minute, but I just wanted to also ask you about the Immigration Safe Zones Act that was also vetoed. What does that have to do with?
Yeah. So, I mean, the basic premise of the Safe Zones Act is that it would empower our state's attorney general to set out guidelines to really clarify what the law is as far as what certain institutions such as hospitals and schools, when they are obligated under the law to cooperate and work with ICE, also known as Immigration Enforcement from the on the federal government level, and when they would not be required to share information or communicate or proactively cooperate with ICE officials. And so that way there's no confusion that our state people in these areas that are often used and bedrocks of communities, not only are residents very clear on what they can expect when they come into these common spaces, but then those institutions and the people that work there are very clear on what the law is and what they are obligated to do and what they're not.
So let's hear what Governor Rauner had to say when he about vetoing these bills. Here he is on radio station WJPF in Southern Illinois.
The second bill basically forces law enforcement to put in applications for illegal immigrants who otherwise would be deported, put in applications for visas to defer being deported in cases where they claim to be victims of crimes, but where they're not necessarily needed for testimony or for investigation. That ties the hands of law enforcement. It can delay deportations, which should otherwise occur. And again, that's a bad bill, and we're going to be vetoing that. We don't want to be tying the hands of our local law enforcement.
That's Governor Rauner on WJPF in Southern Illinois explaining why he vetoed the Voices Act. He also said in his official veto message it would strain the resources of law enforcement for something that he said is, quote, beyond justifiable law enforcement need. And Andy, I wonder what your response would be. It sounds like the governor saying that there are people who are claiming to be victims of domestic violence or human trafficking or sexual abuse, and that it's just a claim, and also that these people aren't needed in the legal process and should be deported?
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess that the governor's answer really kind of breaks my heart. The individuals that he's talking about, you know, this is a bill that the Illinois Coalition Against Domestic Violence helped champion with me down in Springfield. There are very real victims of violence, female victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, that right now are currently looking for assistance with their U visa certification. Just so that your listeners understand, these are individuals living in the shadows that are victims of heinous crimes, and they're in isolation. And all we're asking is that law enforcement fill out a form. If they are in fact a victim, if they believe based on their information that they have, when a person does the right thing and steps out of the shadows and reports a crime, that they help fill out this form. Now, this is a separate process with the federal government. Law enforcement is making no determination other than this person has been a victim of a crime and is likely to cooperate with the investigation. That's something I think we want to encourage all residents of our state to do. And so the U visa, the T visa, that's a program for that purpose, so that people aren't afraid to step out and speak about the crimes that are being committed against them. And it's quite baffling to me that the governor would maybe fixate on a mythical hypothetical that, as far as I'm aware of, I have not heard that story. What I can tell you, there are very real survivors right now that need the help of our elected leaders to really get out of bad situations.
I'm speaking with Andy Kang, who's executive director of Asians Americans Advancing Justice in Chicago. Andy, and I wonder if there are people who are listening who are wondering why this program exists in the first place. And I wanted to ask you, if people who are here and who are unauthorized, does that make them more vulnerable to crimes like domestic abuse?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of... You know, and we can, on the immigration issue, I know that a lot of folks would agree that there's a lot of problems with our immigration system, and that needs to be fixed. And that's something we all hope Congress and the people in D.C. Get to. But in the meantime, there are individuals who are here, and yes, they are not here with legal authorization. When they become a victim of a crime or are in an abusive relationship with a spouse or partner, oftentimes their immigration status is used as leverage for them to have to, in their mind, continue on in that abusive and very dangerous relationship. And I think what we want to create is a society that creates a pathway for those individuals to get out of that situation. And I think on a very human level, everyone understands that. It's one of the reasons that this bill was, you know, supported by so many female legislators down in Springfield, including several Republicans, I might add, that showed real courage and leadership on this issue. And so, you know, again, I think if we can put the partisan considerations to the side for a second and just think, I think we can all agree that we should be doing everything we can to help survivors of these crimes, regardless of their immigration status, that our society is better off by doing that.
The governor did sign two bills regarding immigration. Andy, what can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so one is what we have called in the community the No Registry Act. This basically says something very simple that, you know, the state of Illinois and our government agencies will not be cooperating or providing information if our federal government, for whatever reason, were to create some kind of unconstitutional registry collecting information on individuals based solely on their sort of national origin or other category, protected
categories. Or religion, for example?
Or religion, for example. And, you know, this stems from, unfortunately, a very real fear in our Muslim American communities that something like the Japanese American internment might happen again. And as crazy as that sounds, unfortunately, we've seen things emanating from D.C. that does give community members real concerns about that. And so this was a way of our state. And again, this was something that had zero opposition votes, was strongly bipartisan, that we wanted to be able to send a message that our state, Illinois, is not going to agree and cooperate with something unconstitutional and that targets a specific community without really any basis of suspicion.
And then I know the governor also signed an amendment to the Department of Business and Professional Regulation law that removes some immigration-related barriers for some skilled immigrant professional licenses. So that was also signed. Getting back to the Voices Act, to the Immigration Safe Zones Act, you mentioned the bipartisan support that it had when it passed. Do you feel like this is, I wonder where you guys are now, what the activist community has been doing with lawmakers. Do you have a sense that you will be able to override the governor's vetoes in November?
You know, I think some of that will depend on the November elections, and I know that everyone is very mindful of those results. But I do anticipate with the Voices Act, given the strong amount of support we had, that, yes, we will be seeking and working towards a veto override of the governor's decision. And I'm very optimistic that's, in fact, what we'll be successful in doing. With respect to the other bills, you know, I would have to double check. Don't want to misstate or mislead folks. I think there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, obviously, we have to look at the governor's veto message and the reasons he said that, at least his stated reasons for saying why he vetoed it, and make sure that if there are concerns by members of the General Assembly, that we address them and we have those conversations. But again, you know, I'm just reminded of the fact, you know, over this weekend, the passing of U.S. Senator John McCain, and hearing some of the bio information, some of the stories shared. This was an individual that, you know, put principled leadership over partisan considerations. And when they made mistakes, they admitted that. And I think that's the kind of leadership, not getting hung up on partisanship and really just doing the right thing. And so that's what we're going to be appealing to all the legislators down in Springfield in the fall after the elections. But in the meantime, I think it's just making sure that our community members don't lose hope, that they realize that whether it's this year or next, these are bills. They're good bills. They're ones that protect our communities, and I think the state benefits from them, and we're not giving up. We're going to keep fighting.
That's Andy Kang. He's Executive Director of Asian Americans Advancing Justice in Chicago. Andy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
When it comes to our health, what can Chicago learn from Toronto? That's the question DePaul University and Rush University Medical Center researchers looked at. When it comes to racial segregation in tiny babies who at birth weigh less than 5.5 pounds. First, the researchers established a link between segregation and these low birth weights. In Chicago's worse-off communities, one out of every five babies is born weighing less than 5.5 pounds, and that's an alarm bell for other health problems later in life. But in looking at four U.S. communities in Toronto, they found it doesn't have to be this way. To learn more about this, I'm joined on the line by Fernando de Mayo. He's a sociology professor at DePaul University. He's also co-director of the Center for Community Health Equity. That's a collaboration of DePaul and Rush in Chicago. Hi, Fernando. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us on the line from Toronto is Patricia Ocampo, a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. She's also a research scientist at the Center for Urban Health Solutions. Patricia, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us, too.
Thank you.
Fernando, can I start with you and ask why look at low birth weight rates? Is that a signal of bigger health problems in a community?
Sure, yeah. We use low birth weight as an important metric of population health. Kind of clusters with other important indicators like small for gestational age, prematurity, and probably the most important indicator of all of infant mortality.
Okay. And you found out in Chicago and in Baltimore, nearly one in five babies in the worst off communities have a low birth weight. How does that compare to the best off communities in the city?
Yeah, so we have about a five-fold difference or even a six-fold difference between the best-off and the worst-off communities in these cities. And that was really the most important feature of our study, that we wanted to compare communities across places. Many other studies study the cities themselves or the state, looking at average rates and how they change over time. But we wanted to take this, what we call an equity lens, and really compare the worst-off and the best-off across place to see how much difference we can expect in that relationship.
And when we think about that difference, I think your study found that communities with highly segregated African-American populations fared the worst, while segregated Latino communities did not fare so badly. Why do you think that is?
That's right, yeah. So we're thinking that this taps into a very complex kind of process of the social determinants of health, of how minority status is defined, particularly in the United States, and how the experience of racism and discrimination is experienced across the life course. What we're seeing with the predominantly Hispanic communities might be a reflection of a foreign-born effect, right? So a higher proportion of immigrants living in those communities, which haven't been exposed to the same levels of discrimination across the life course.
You know, and when you think about that, when you think about discrimination or when we think about problems with segregation and we think about how that relates to healthcare, Fernando, I think we tend to think that these disparities are perhaps inevitable. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. Well, you know, in some of our work, we've traced the history of health disparities in Chicago. And the first map that we found like this was 1901 in the American Journal of Sociology that plotted the excess concentration of child mortality in some neighborhoods. So that fundamental problem has stayed the same, right? There's the pattern of deep-rooted inequality that manifests in health disparities, but it doesn't have to be that way. And we're seeing that health disparities or health inequities are dynamic. They can and do change over time. And that was the big lesson from Toronto in this analysis. We took the same scale that we had in Chicago. We plotted it on a map, and we took that same scale and we applied it to the map of the Toronto neighborhoods. And we produce what I think is a really beautiful map. It's essentially one color. There were a couple pockets of difference, better and worse, but it was predominantly a pretty steady pattern showing that if we applied that same scale, the inequalities just aren't there. It's in the same bandwidth. And that shows us how different it can be.
Well, we have to take a break, but when we come back, Patricia, I'm hoping you can weigh in. Patricia Ocampo is with us from Toronto. She's on the line where she's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. And she's going to talk a little bit more for us. Patricia, I'm hoping you can weigh in about what segregation looks like in Toronto and a little bit more about this study, why you think this is different in Canada versus here in the U.S. Stay tuned to the 21st. After this short break, we're going to continue this conversation with Patricia Ocampo and Fernando de Mayo from DePaul University. By the way, that study that they just put out, that research, we will tweet that link if you'd like to see us. Our handle is 21STShow. Stay tuned to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about how Chicago and Toronto are both diverse cities that are about the same size, but when it comes to the health of our babies, we're learning why our neighbors to the north are doing a much better job than we are. My guests are Fernando De Mayo. He's a sociology professor at DePaul University and a co-director of the Center for Community Health Equity. That's a collaboration with DePaul and Rush University Medical Center. We're talking about his research with also his with Patricia Ocampo, who's a professor in Toronto at the University of Toronto in the School of Public Health. Patricia, just before the break, Fernando was explaining the discrepancies and the differences in Chicago. What does it look? What does segregation and what does the differences among babies who are born underweight look like in Toronto between Toronto's worst and best off neighborhoods?
Sure. First, I'd like to congratulate Dr. De Mayo and his colleagues. They've done a really great job of putting a new lens on this issue by comparing cities. In Toronto, I guess we're fortunate enough to have lower levels of inequality. So if you look at the difference between, say, the lowest income quartile and the highest income quartile, we only have a difference of about 30%. There is a difference. There's inequalities actually in every city across the world. But we're lucky enough to see smaller inequalities between the richest and the poorest here in Toronto.
And Patricia, is it luck? What else do you suspect is the reason for why this is the case?
Yes. Well, I guess low birth weight is actually not an exception for health and well-being. Actually, Canada and the U.S. have been compared on a wide variety of outcomes, and we see a similar story to what we see here. And that's in part because in Canada we do have a single-payer health system where everybody has access to the healthcare system. And I think that is one big difference between the U.S. and Canada. Another one is that certainly in Toronto we have a high level of social services or a reasonable social safety net. And so that tends to raise the floor for those who are in the lowest income. That is, they have access to many resources that will lessen the negative impacts of something like poverty.
Mm-hmm. And Fernando, when we think about what Chicago can learn from Toronto, obviously those are really big differences between Canada and the U.S. And I wonder what a city like Chicago can do to address that when obviously the whole idea of a universal single-payer healthcare system is something that we've been debating for quite some time and clearly are not going to get to anytime soon, Fernando. How can Chicago change this?
Yeah, I guess first it's understanding the problem, right? Like, I think the evidence points to a clear fact that every community in Chicago has experienced an improvement in health status over the past 20, 30 years, but the gap between the communities has persisted and in some cases has increased. So probably the first thing is just to recognize that fundamental issue that inequities or differences that are avoidable, unnecessary, and unfair will persist and will at times grow if we're not tune into them and prioritize them in our public policy.
Mm. And are there any, I know when we think about Chicago has a new public health plan, I believe it's Healthy Chicago 2.0. Are there solutions in there that you think can help address this problem?
Yeah, there are. I was part of one of the working groups for that plan on chronic disease in particular. And I think that plan overall took a very ambitious approach to prioritize what they call the hardship index and the child opportunity index. So those are going to be underlying metrics under which all health interventions and plans would have been kind of proposed against. So I think the city is taking very significant steps to put health equity as a central goal, recognizing that that's a key to making it a fair, more humane place to live.
Patricia, do you have a sense that some of these differences between Canada and the U.S., are they Toronto-specific solutions versus the Canadian federal government? Are there things cities can do to help improve this?
Well, I do think there's an advantage that Canada has over the U.S. for the reasons that I mentioned, but there is something that Toronto does which I think might be particularly relevant for low birth weight, given that when we think about low birth weight, it really is an indicator of the health of women in a community. And one of the things that Toronto does is it takes a gender-based analysis to many of its city policies. And so we try and ensure that policies don't leave women behind, because when we don't take a gender-based analysis to really important social determinants of health, like employment or unemployment insurance or social assistance policies, we tend to leave women behind. And so it's really important to whatever policy that you're thinking about implementing or analyzing, that you look at it using a gender-based lens.
Even if it's, as you're saying, not regarding healthcare, but, for example, employment or education.
Exactly.
Fernando, what's next for your research?
We're kind of following an idea that comes from an anthropologist named Paul Farmer of geographically broad and historically deep analysis, recognizing that, say, to understand low birth weight in North Lawndale, we can't understand it in isolation. We have to understand it in comparison to other cities, other communities, as we're doing, and also tracking things over time. So some of the new data that we're looking at shows that there's been no change at all in the prevalence of low birth weight in Chicago since 1980. And no change at all in the association between minority segregation and low birth weight, or poverty and low birth weight. So we're trying to track what we call the dynamics of this outcome over time and across space.
That's Fernando de Mayo. He's a sociology professor at DePaul University and also co-director of the Center for Community Health Equity. I want to thank Patricia Ocampo for being with us as well. She's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. She's also a research scientist at the Center for Urban Health Solutions. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Last week, Google announced a $1 million grant award program specifically designed for Illinois nonprofits. It's the internet company's first statewide challenge to help promote economic development and opportunity. This fall, Google and a panel of advisors will choose 10 nonprofits as finalists, and they want the public to pick the winner. Here to explain more are Google Chicago's community engagement manager, Stephen Brokaw, and Larry Dietz, president of Illinois State University, who's on the advisory panel. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
President Dietz, can I start with you? What kind of economic development ideas are you hoping to see come out of this?
Well, first, I want to say I was delighted to be selected by Google and to serve with distinguished colleagues on this panel. The state of Illinois, as you may know, over the course of the last several years have had a lot of financial challenges, and as a result of that, a lot of the nonprofits have had their finances diminished considerably, and so I think that this is an opportunity provided by Google for those nonprofits that are existing and others that want to get into the fray to exercise their imagination and their innovation to come up with good ideas that will serve underserved populations across the state. So I have great confidence in those creativity of those individuals to come forth with wonderful ideas.
And when you're thinking about the Bloomington-Normal area and your campus in particular, are there specific needs that you see within your community that you'd love to see addressed?
Well, I think our community is not unlike other communities really across the state in that, you know, there are agencies that had really had to cut their services and some went out of existence as a result of the lack of state investment and decline in some donations in some cases. So I think that this will give a real incentive for those organizations to come forward and be creative again and have some financial incentives to do so, and I have faith that they'll do that. In the meantime, you know, selfishly, I hope that a lot of the agencies in the Bloomington-Normal area and the outlying county will come forward with good ideas. But I also have sent a note to all of my colleagues at other public universities throughout the state to let them know about this initiative also, and I sent that out at the end of last week, and asking them to follow their through their outreach and extension areas to follow our lead a little bit in this and getting the word out. We have a civic engagement and collaboration value of the university, and so we know that they're going to be interested in trying to get the word out as well. So we're just hopeful that a lot of good and creative ideas will come out of this, and I'm sure that they will.
That's Larry Dietz, who's president of Illinois State University. Stephen Brokaw is also with us from Google Chicago. Stephen, how's this going to work?
Thanks so much for having us. So our application period is open now, and we're hopeful that nonprofits throughout the state will put forward their best ideas for how to help create economic opportunity wherever they are in the state. And then those applications will be due on September 21st. After that, we will go through everything. And then in conjunction with our six wonderful advisors, of which we're very grateful to have President Dietz, and then we'll select 10 winners. Each of those will receive a $75,000 grant. And then after that, we're going to open it up for public voting. And the public will decide which one they think has the most promise. And that one will receive an additional $250,000 in grant funding.
And how is that going to work? Are you going to have just everyone vote online, or how are people going? Okay.
Everyone will vote through our Google.org Impact Challenge Illinois website, which is up now, and that's where people can go to learn more about the challenge and apply. And the website address for that is just g.co/Illinois Challenge.
Okay, and we will tweet that out. We'll have that at our website as well if folks didn't catch that. Stephen, and what are the requirements for nonprofits who apply? Just that they're a registered 501c3, or are there other requirements?
There are a few other requirements. You can see them in our rules, but basically you're right. Are you a qualified nonprofit 501c3 with a material presence in Illinois, and it doesn't really call for more than that. You check those boxes and then let us know your idea and how you propose to help create economic opportunity.
Stephen, I know you're a Bloomington Normal native. How important is it for you personally to see Google investing in nonprofits outside of the Chicago area?
I am a proud Central Illinoisan, and I've gotten the pleasure of working on our previous impact challenges that have been city-based, and that's why I'm particularly so excited to do our first statewide challenge in my home state. And, having grown up in Bloomington Normal, and I'm an Illini for law school, and I've spent a lot of time at my dad's farm around Peoria, it's critical that we get great ideas from throughout the state. There's no one particular area that has a monopoly on great ideas, and we're just really, really looking forward to having great ideas come forth from throughout the state.
Stephen, why did you all pick economic development and opportunity to focus on?
So last October, we launched our Grow with Google program with our CEO, Sundar, in Pittsburgh. And, Google believes strongly that technology is a force for leveling the playing field for everyone. And we think digital skills have a huge part in helping be that leveling force to help create economic opportunity for everyone. And it's just a big area where we're hoping to do as much as we can to help people prepare for the jobs of today and tomorrow and help them grow their skills and careers and businesses.
And Stephen Brokaw, he's Google Chicago's Community Engagement Manager. I want to thank him as well as President Dietz. President Dietz, I know this is a very busy time of year for you. Thank you for joining us at the start of the school year for Illinois State University. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
It's always a
thank
pleasure.
You so much.
Thank you very much.
As I said, we'll have more information at our website at 21stshow.org. That's always a good place to go if you're looking for more information on that Google Award Challenge. That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the flooding in the Indian state of Kerala has caused hundreds of deaths. According to the BBC, more than 1 million more people have been displaced. Here in Illinois, we're going to be talking about what's needed in terms of aid and relief and talking to two men who've helped raise more than $1.5 million in a Facebook campaign to help provide natural disaster relief. So tune in to tomorrow's 21st for that. As I mentioned, our website's a great place to go if you want to find our social media handles, our Twitter, our Facebook. If you want to email us, send us a voicemail. We'd love to hear feedback from you. Just head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information on that. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Steve Mork. Thanks to Christine Herman for helping out with producing help today. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.